Introducing Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB, AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book, When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. He's also a portfolio manager and financial advisor in Edmonton. Welcome back to the show, Hilliard.
It's great to be back on the show. I just got back from Antarctica, and I'm just happy to be back.
I was going to say, so you're warming up in Edmonton at minus 38.
Yeah, it was only like zero in Antarctica. It's way colder here in Edmonton.
Well, of course, it's summertime there.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
Now, how are things in the sovereign state of Alberta right now? What's the mood?
Well, the mood is turbulent because the government brought in a bill, the first bill, which is the Sovereignty Act of Alberta, and it's causing great discomfort in many circles, and it's got some support, but it would appear that the leader, the new leader, Danielle Smith, is basically got herself on the hot seat here, and I don't know, she's backed down a little bit. She the bill originally delegated powers to the cabinet to go ahead and do stuff without checking with the legislature first, and they've backed down on that one. They will require it to go through the legislature, which is the way it should have been all along. But there's very divided opinions. And of course, she hasn't faced the electorate in a general election, so that's probably coming up fairly soon. All she's done is won the leadership of her party. So, and of course, on the other side, you've got, great Rachel Notley, who has been premier and, got defeated in the last election, but she's still there, and she's hoping to defeat the right-wing Conservative Party this next time around. So it'll be an interesting battle, and it's probably going to come fairly soon, probably like next spring sometime. So I don't think it's required to be that soon, but usually when they got a leader that's hasn't faced a general election, that usually happens fairly soon.
I saw a thing where the Calgary Chamber of Commerce was concerned because business investment in Alberta, they're trying to encourage it so you can somehow wean yourself off oil and gas to some extent. And they're just worried that investors might get the wrong message or a confusing message about, well, just how stable is Alberta to do business in? Would you consider it a stable environment?
Well, I think the investment in Alberta would probably ignore that that act. You know, the people that are investing big dollars would recognize that it's more of a stunt than a real change in policy. And the party in power, the United Conservative Party, has already got several of the big oil and gas companies to come out and say, "Oh, we're not concerned about the act." But on the other hand, I mean, it is pretty far out there, and it's just a symbol of our times. I mean, how long ago was it when we had truckers blocking the road in downtown Ottawa? So it's or at least alleged truckers blocking the road in downtown Ottawa.
What about the Alberta opposition? The NDP considered quite a leftist party. How left are they in Alberta, and what's their attitude towards business?
Well, they wouldn't be considered very left-wing in anywhere other than Alberta, I think, because the big wedge issue, of course, in Alberta is what are you going to do about the oil sands? Because the climate change promises that the federal government's made in these international treaties and meetings is pretty ambitious and requires a significant drop in carbon dioxide emissions just in the next 8 to 15 years. And it's impossible to imagine how that could happen without somehow curtailing the emissions from the oil sands. Well, of course, the NDP party in Alberta has taken the opposite view. They feel that they shouldn't curtail the emissions from the oil sands. So that puts them in direct opposition to people that are in favor of taking action to lower emissions. And so it's a battleground. So you got two parties in Alberta, both of whom are in favor of higher emissions from the oil patch. And so you'd have to say probably both of them are fairly right wing in that, at least on that one measure.
And isn't Alberta the world's leader in carbon capture? And aren't they also investing some billions into that?
Yeah, the government money going to carbon capture is great, but it's all it's pretty much all at the laboratory bench. You know they're trying to scale up the usage of carbon capture, but there's two or three plants only in the world that are actually trying to do carbon capture, and they're very very the results are very mixed. And so far, the only use of once you capture the carbon, the big question is what do you do with the carbon when it's captured, and the oil patch uses it to stimulate wells. So the current plants in Alberta capture carbon, and then they re-inject it down into the well to stimulate further oil production. So the people that are people on the other side of the argument are just totally against carbon capture. The people that are in favor of carbon capture are arguing that the carbon should be buried in the ground deeply somewhere where it won't get released. So there's basically, it's all pretty new technology if you go to that next step where you actually just bury the carbon in the ground.
Hell, it could turn into new oil, maybe.
Yeah. A billion years from now.
Yeah. You know,
maybe the dinosaurs would come back and it would be helpful. I don't know, but it's pretty far-fetched. And the other argument against carbon capture, of course, is it's very expensive and you also have to burn fossil fuels in order to capture the carbon, right? So.
Yeah.
So a lot of people would prefer that you just stop burning fossil fuels and then you wouldn't have to capture the carbon because it wouldn't be created in the first place.
The Bank of Canada hiked its trend-setting rate once again. What's that done to mortgage rates?
So mortgage rates jumped about the same amount. Not right away. The one interest rate that jumps right away is the prime rate. So it's jumped right up to it's over 6% now, I think 6.45% or something like that. It's just ridiculously high. Now, usually you can borrow at a discount to prime rate. I don't know, but mortgage rates are now up in the between 5 and 6%, depending on what kind of mortgage you take out. But the big one is the variable rate mortgage, because as you know, we've talked about this in the past. In order to qualify during the COVID times when that big surge in mortgage borrowing happened, most people had to opt for a variable rate mortgage because that's the only way they could qualify with the stress test that was in place at the time and still is in place. And so now all those people are facing increases. They were getting, I talked to one guy, oh yeah, I can't believe this. This is hard to believe, but he was saying that he got 1.8% or 1.9% on a variable rate mortgage. But he's now facing 5.5% or even now after yesterday's jump, this week's jump in interest rates, probably as much as 5.5-6% on a variable rate mortgage. So a lot of these people, one young guy I talked to, he just bought a house and he'd been talking to me and I said, just wait and why don't you rent? But he went ahead and bought anyway, which is my usual experience with those conversations. His friends that bought, they opted for a variable rate and he opted for a fixed rate. And he claims he got like a 2% fixed rate about a year and a half ago. Mm-hmm. And his friends got a variable rate. And now he said at least two of them had to sell their homes that they bought at that time because they just can't afford the new payments. So the payments, the increase is something like in the order of $1,000 to $1,500 a month once the variable rate resets. So this, most of these people, they're not the people this guy I was talking to is not a high income person. He's a low income person. He just can't handle $1,000 to $1,500. But luckily for him, he opted for the fixed rate. But, that's not, a lot of them weren't able to take the fixed rate because they couldn't qualify on the fixed rate. They could only qualify on the variable rate. So now we're going to see a reset. And there's all kinds of business rates that are tied to the prime lending rate. There's just a huge amount of, recalibration of debt. David Rosenberg, the economist, he estimates that it's going to be something like a 4% hit to consumer spending. Just the wealth effect alone, people have lost so much money and the higher interest rates on their interest payments. lost money on their housing, the value of their housing, which was a driver of spending in the consumer level. The 4% hit is a severe recession. It's not a mild recession. It's a severe recession.
Bank of Canada keeps saying, it's just going to be a soft landing, a soft recession, if there is one. Is there such a thing as a soft recession?
Well, there probably is, but we're not going to get one. it's like the unicorn, you know, everybody's looking for the last time, the only comparable period that I can find is the late 70s, early 80s. And I'm one of the few people, I probably shouldn't brag about this because it makes me really old, but I'm one of the few people that was actively working in the investment business starting in 1978. So I would live through that period. And every week, every month, we'd come through and interest rates would go higher and higher, and people, you know, would say, oh, inflation can't go any higher, and then it went higher. Yeah. So inflation peaked out around 12%, interest rates peaked out around 18%, and the recession in 1982, which is the only comparable period I can find to this, what we're going through now, was a very severe recession. Like, a ton of people lost their homes, all the speculators lost their businesses or they lost their homes. And the thing that is even scarier in this particular round, a lot of the comparables are similar. The interest rates aren't quite as high and the inflation rate isn't quite as high yet. But the difference this time is that indebted levels of every level of society, governments, businesses, and consumers are much, much higher than they were back in 1979, 1980. So we're probably going to have a fairly nasty recession to even think about getting through this. Now, the central bankers might realize that. They just can't say it out loud, or they might not realize it. they're just sort of sleepwalking through this thing. But the latest increase, they hinted at the end of the statement that maybe this will be the last rate increase. Well, it strikes me as wishful thinking. The only way that could happen, and there is a way it could happen, is if we get into a nasty recession. And then, of course, that would be the last interest rate increase. They'd be starting to think about lowering rates. But if they're talking about a soft landing or a mild recession, there's no way that that's the last interest rate increase. The inflation rate's just too high.
Now, I recall that period in Moose Jaw, a housing developer couldn't sell the houses that he had just built because of the high mortgage rates. And so he started bulldozing them with a front-end loader. And he was finally stopped. He started knocking down the house that he lived in. His wife was still in the house, and the police had to put a warning shot through the windshield of the loader to stop him. And then people came from miles around to take a look at the houses that had been destroyed. And there was the loader sitting there at a very precarious angle with the bullet hole in it. Those were desperate times. Do you think we're going to see anything like that again?
Well, we will, because the thing about developers I learned in the research for my two books on housing is that they borrow at a different interest rate. They borrow at a much higher interest rate than regular people because they go to the private lending market. The banks are understandably quite nervous about lending to real estate developers. There was one big developer went broke in Edmonton a few years ago, like 3 or 4 years ago. And the Royal Bank had lent him $200 million. But that's unusual. That's not the norm. Most of these builders, they end up going to the private lenders, and the loans are for 1 year maximum. And they're in the double digits, 10, 12, 15%. And there's no interest payable during the year. The interest is all paid in one balloon payment at the end of the year when the loan matures. And having talked to some of the private lenders, they tell me, well, yeah, most of the times they take out these. And I said, why do they borrow at such high rates? And he says, well, they all expect that they're going to repay them before the year is up. So they're all really optimistic. I said, well, how many of them actually do it? He said, well, sometimes they do, but most of the time they renew. And there's renewal fees. So not only did they pay like 10 to 15% interest, but when they renew at the end of the year, there's a renewal fee. So as long as the private lenders have money to lend out, because unlike a bank, they can't create money out of thin air. They need the actual money in their bank account before they can lend it to the house builder. If that money dries up, which is what's happening now, then there's no money available. And even if the borrower is willing to pay 20% interest, they just can't get a loan. So that's the next step in this thing, and there's going to be a lot of stress in the private lending market and in the bank lending area as well. The banks, you know, the banks are much more careful than the private lenders, but they'll get caught as well. So we're heading into a pretty severe credit crunch. And I just did one of my associates, Fraser Betkowski, he checks on the bank's provisions for credit losses, which is, you can check every, they just had their earnings, they just finished their earnings cycle, and they're very close to zero, very little reserves for loan losses. And this is typical when there's been a long period when there's been no bad loans, but it's one of the lowest ever on record, going back to 1980. And at the high end, the provisions usually get up to 1% during a recession, and often as high as 1.5 to 2%. So that's what's coming. And when the banks have to take provisions from close to zero up to 1 or 2% of total loans outstanding, some of them have 500 billion in loans, some of them have the total amount of loans is very high, in the trillions of dollars. Those are huge, basically hits to the bank earnings when they have to increase their provisions, and they will have to. They'll have to do that if we go into any kind of severe recession. So it isn't just the central banks that are doing wishful thinking. The lenders are also in denial about this thing, and they're in doing quite a bit of wishful thinking as well.
Canada's housing crisis, rents are sky high, but if developers aren't encouraged to put new buildings up, how are we going to solve the rental crisis?
I think there's a lot of purpose-built renting going up. The CMHC's got a really attractive loan package for people that want to put up rentals. The only problem is when they build them, the rents are too high, right? So the brand new buildings are, they're asking for $2,000-$3,000 a month rent, and of course most people can't afford. The sweet spot for rents, unless wages go up a lot, it's probably around $1,000 to $1,500 a month. And so what will happen is these new buildings will get built. They'll be forced to rent out at $1,000 to $1,500 a month, and they'll lose a little bit of money. But most of them are owned by pension plans. So once the developer finishes the rental building, gets it all rented up, turns it over and sells it to an investor, usually a big pension plan or a life insurance company, something like that. So there will be rentals available. And then of course all of these properties we were just talking about that have been built by builders, that they aren't able to sell, the lenders may cooperate with them and say, well, why don't you finish off your subdivision? Cause what's the point of having a house half built? And then they'll probably end up renting them out. So that'll be, that'll help with supply as well. And, I think once you take the speculators out of the equation, which is what these higher interest rates is doing now or has already done, then you'll find that there's more supply in the housing market than people think. There's a tremendous number of properties that are being held for speculation rather than being rented out, and they'll all get switched over to the rental market fairly quickly.
What's the vacant office space situation in Alberta?
It's 30% officially in Calgary, and something similar to that in Edmonton. I haven't seen the number. Calgary's the one everybody focuses on because the head offices of a lot of companies are in Calgary. And but unofficially, it's probably much higher than that because, when you sign a lease, as often as 10 years, it's usually a minimum of 5-year lease, and often 10 years. It's considered fully occupied, even if the people that are renting it for 10 years don't have all the space filled. But then of course when the lease comes up for renewal, then they try to take smaller space. So there's all kinds of attempts to sublease, but it doesn't really work very well. And so a lot of people are just sitting on a lot of excess office space. And that's even before you tackle the idea of work from home. So people like me, I was sort of back and forth. Now I'm officially full-time work from home. There's a lot of people like me, and so I don't even have an office. I do go into the office, but all I do is go to one of the meeting rooms and meet with clients or meet with our team, and I don't need an office space. So, it's, you know, there's excess space that way too. So if you counted all of that, there'd be a lot of work to calculate that, and there's no incentive for anybody to calculate it. It would be even higher than 30%.
How's Alberta's plan to entice professionals from other provinces working out?
You know, it's interesting because I've gone through this a bit with people in Toronto and in the financial industry. You know, of course, most of the head offices, almost all of the head offices of the large financial organizations are in Toronto. And I've suggested to them over the years, going back probably 15 years, say, you know, you can move your head office to Calgary. I usually don't say Edmonton because that's like a step too far for most of them.
Yeah.
But they know Calgary. And I say, you know, you could save so much money on office rent, but also the executives who are paying like $5 million for a house in the Toronto area could easily get a really nice equivalent house for $1 or $2 million, or, you know, quite a bit less anyway. And the difference in Calgary would be that you could walk to work. Downtown Calgary from the more expensive neighbors is a 45-minute walk and a 5-minute car drive. So they just look at me with a blank stare because they just don't, they can't imagine. But they, you know, in the going back 40 years, when I started, they had to be located in downtown Toronto because at the end of the day, all the settlements were done with paper. It's paper stock certificates, paper bank drafts, all that sort of stuff. So there were couriers. Luckily, nobody knew this. They were walking around with these little satchels that they had. They had, you know, millions or tens of millions of dollars worth of stock certificates walking around downtown Toronto and New York. And they would go into safety deposit box and it all worked. But nowadays it's all electronic. So there's no need for these clearing transactions to happen in one physical location. But it takes, because the leases are 10 years long, it takes a long, and even longer is the attitude, you know, the habit. It takes a long time to decentralize these things, but eventually, probably they will be decentralized. I was reading, for instance, in London, the London Stock Exchange used to be by far the biggest exchange outside of New York and the London Financial District and all that. Apparently, a lot of it's moved now to Europe, to Frankfurt and Paris and other places. So
yeah, apparently Paris is bigger now on the financial market than London. Yeah,
it's hard to believe, and yet. Why not? I mean, you know, it's cheaper to live in Paris than it is to live. I mean, I'm not saying it's cheap to live in Paris, but it's cheaper than London, which is ridiculously expensive. And so why not move it around a little bit? And it's where people want to live. And as long as, you know, there are some people like Elon Musk who insist that people have to come to work every day and physically show up, and he doesn't believe that work from home actually works. But maybe he's, you know, in his industry, it's different. But I think in the financial industry, actually work from home probably does work because people are, you know, basically interacting, through, electronic means all day anyway. So what difference does it make if you're sitting next to somebody or sitting, 100 miles away?
It works for broadcasting working from home because when you go to a radio station, you sit in a little room and talk to yourself. So why not do that at home?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the sound booths, when I did interviews for the media, they'd have a little sound booth or something like that, which is really, really, but you could set up a little sound booth like that at home quite easily and get your special microphone and yeah, everything's all good. And, now the only thing is some people don't have home situations that are even in our situation, we had to do a renovation in our home to separate out you know, the two people here, my wife and I, if we're both on some kind of a call like this or a Zoom call or some other kind of thing, you have to be separated. So we had to do a renovation and I guess that's why I'm in the basement now. I used to be upstairs.
You got demoted.
I got relegated to the basement. That's okay. I like it down here. I got a little window I can see, so it's all good.
We'll have more with Hilliard Macbeth right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Hilliard Macbeth. Hilliard, I've heard talk that some people say they won't buy a Tesla or they're going to trade their Tesla in because they don't like what Elon Musk has done with Twitter. Do you have any plans to give up your Tesla?
No, I don't. And I don't. Well, first of all, what would you buy? I mean, I actually, I know that I mentioned I just got back from Antarctica. So on the trip on Antarctica, we were on a ship with a bunch of people for 20 days, and quite a few of the naturalists about 10, I think there was about 10 naturalists. They're specialists in marine life or birds or different things. And one of them was a photographer for the National Geographic. And she said, I really want to get an electric car. I'm waiting for a Mercedes. Well, I didn't ask her, but obviously exactly what you're saying is affecting her. She doesn't like Elon Musk for some reason. And so she can't buy a Tesla. So she's waiting for a Mercedes. So this is happening, but the thing is, Tesla is so far ahead that it's going to be very difficult for Mercedes or BMW or Volkswagen or any of these places. The only people that are threatening Tesla right at this time in the car industry are the Chinese, and there's several new products coming from BYD and other Chinese companies. And my guess is they're very good. And I can't believe it, but in January 2023, like a month from now, BYD is going to start delivering a car to Germany, all-electric car to Germany. And also, I just read recently that Australia is getting cars from China as well, so we may see them. So I think that it'll be a question of if people want to go electric, they'll look at the offering, and they may, if they don't like Elon Musk, then they'll probably end up buying Tesla anyway, and they'll just have to hold their nose and buy it, but hopefully there's other offerings that come out too, because I would hate for people to not go electric just because of the controversy over Elon Musk's character. And as far as Twitter's concerned, I sure hope that Twitter survives, because actually it's a fairly big part of my life, and I find that I've met lots of fascinating people on Twitter. I've followed up sometimes with in-person meetings with them or Zoom calls, and it's just a sharing of information that it just, as far as I know, wouldn't be possible any other way. So there are frustrations. There's trolls that come on and try and mess up your thoughts and your opinions and stuff. But maybe that's part of it too. It toughens you up a little bit too. So I don't think Elon's going to wreck Twitter. I mean, he does. His track record is very good, whether you like him or not. He's been very successful in most of the stuff he's done. And so he's going to spend $44 billion to wreck something? I don't think so. I think he'll find a way to make it work. And it's one of those core franchises that probably will survive even Elon Musk. So it'll be interesting. And the controversy that he attracts is probably part of his publicity as well.
Of course.
He gets a lot of free media from people like us. He doesn't pay a single dollar for advertising, unlike General Motors and Ford and Chrysler and all these companies. And, so it's, but I wish he would stick more to, I really wish he would stick more to his amazing, ability to make advancements in engineering and science and that sort of thing, and do less, especially in politics. I wish he would stay away from politics, but he seems to be drifting into that area now too. So.
Yeah, there's something attractive about politics and money, isn't there?
Well, you think about, I remember 2016 having an argument with a wealthy person from New York City, who was saying, oh, Donald Trump's gonna fix healthcare because he's going to bring in the private sector, they're gonna revolutionize healthcare. And I've watched this for a long time, and the track record of successful business people who go into politics is abysmal. Like the politics is way more complicated than business, and they should just stay away from it, because there's too many unknowns, too many variables, and it's not linear like a lot of businesses are. It's multifactorial, and so I wish he would stay away from that, because it'll just drag him down, and he in the long run he probably won't be successful. So but I do think that. I really do hope that Twitter survives. It wasn't on a good path. It's a wonderful franchise, but it wasn't going in a good direction. So maybe he'll redirect it into a better direction, and then maybe hopefully step away and let somebody else run it.
Hilliard, is there anything else that we should be keeping a close eye on right now?
Well, it's interesting that, it's interesting we've gone this far. We haven't talked about house prices coming down. So and there's all these different benchmarks and average and median house prices and stuff. But according to the financial segment of the National Post, David Rosenberg, who's an economist I've followed for a long time, he says that house prices are down 14%, and he expects another 25% from here. So that's a total of 39%. And I would guess that's probably about accurate. The first edition of my book, I said it's going to take a 50% reduction in house prices. But I would think 40% would be good enough to get us well on the way back to affordability. And, but that means a severe recession. There's no getting around it. So far, I mean, mostly what's happened is house prices have come down a lot, and the sellers have said, oh, I'm not selling at that price. So they pulled their house off the market. So the listings are extremely low, and the prices are coming down based on the few sales that there are. But the next step in that whole process would be when lenders get involved and say, and they don't care what the price is. They just want to get the property sold. And so that would be the next step. And we're not there yet. The lenders are willing to work with people to help them get through this. I've seen stories about 40-year amortizations or interest-only loans or all kinds of gimmicks to get people to stay in their home and keep making payments to the lender and not trigger a foreclosure. But eventually there'll be some of that foreclosure coming, I imagine, and that'll push prices down even further.
Well, didn't prices go up something like 20% a year for the last 2.5 years? So we'd actually go back to what we were at 2.5, 3 years ago.
Actually, the math works a little bit differently. So if the price goes up to $1 million or something, a 40% reduction from $1 million is actually a bigger amount because it's 40% of a bigger number, right? So that brings you down to 600,000, which would take you back to probably 2015 or 2017, something like that, on the average Toronto house price. And so it's a pretty big setback. But the big thing is, of course, those people that took out the mortgages, to buy the million-dollar homes, they've got $700,000, $800,000, $900,000, $1 million left on their debt. And so a $600,000 home is going to be a disaster for them. And it's unfortunate that some people have to go through that, but we have to break out of the cycle of excessive debt. And people speculators have to get back to the situation where they're afraid to take on that amount of debt because of the risk. And that's going to take some pretty severe price changes.
Hilliard, best of the season, and we'll chat soon.
Thanks very much, Jim.
My guest has been Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book, When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. His website, MacbethMacLeodPartners.com. Find him on Twitter at HMacBE. If you have any questions for Hilliard or any of our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. We'll ask that question for you. Our popular YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on Twitter at HowStreet. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com, HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.